Welcome to the launch of Developing Expertise for Teaching in Higher Education, Practical Ideas for Professional Learning and Development. Normally, in previous times, these sorts of book launches would be kind of in person, maybe in a fancy venue, a bit of champagne, contributors doing book signings. Unfortunately, we can't offer that today, but actually what we can offer is, I think, something much more inclusive and an opportunity for people and colleagues across the UK and internationally to join us. The session is being recorded, so for those who are unable to attend today, you can pick it up later. I'm also going to send around a copy of the PowerPoint presentation to all attendees so that you can have direct access to the links that are in there, and a reminder of the discount code for the book. So just a little bit of housekeeping. You'll notice that your video and microphones have been switched off. That's simply just because we're expecting so many people. But please do use the chat box for any comments or. So I am Helen King, for those who don't know me. I'm currently Deputy Director of Academic Practice at the University of the West of England in Bristol, and the editor of the book, but I'm by no means not the only contributor, as I'll be mentioning later. So this book is part of the Routledge CEDA series. And so as co-chair of CEDA, I feel I ought to say a few words about that organisation just before we go into the book. So CEDA was formed in 1993, so next year's our 30th birthday. And it's a values-led professional association for colleagues who support, lead and inspire change in higher education. We're seen by many as a shaper of thought and initiator of action in educational development in the UK and internationally, and are a founder member of the International Consortium for Educational Development. We offer a range of activities and services to our members and colleagues across the sector, including our magazine, Educational Developments, the journal, Innovations in Education and Teaching International, and our series of CEDA specials. We've got regular networking and development events, our own fellowship scheme to recognise those who support and lead educational change, and we also accredit professional development courses. A key part of our publication strategy is this book series with Routledge, which currently comprises 32 books since 1996. And it provides a comprehensive contribution to the development of learning and teaching and assists in the professional development of staff. And the range of books presents new ideas for learning development and to facilitate the exchange of information and good practice. So this particular book arose from a symposium on expertise, which I organised in October 2020. Originally conceived as an on-campus event for around 30 people from the local region, the pandemic forced it online, which opened it up to over 500 registrations from across the UK and internationally. We had a fantastic range of contributions which explored the various elements of expertise, and the majority of these, including 36 individuals, have been curated in the book. There are too many for me to say out loud individually, but I'm truly grateful to all of them for their hard work and commitment to crafting their contributions and meeting my deadlines. So the premise of the symposium and the book is based on the extensive literature on the nature of expertise in general and the nature of expertise in a wide variety of fields and domains. And my first chapter explores this in more depth and draws parallels with learning and teaching in order to propose a model for considering the characteristics of expertise for teaching higher education. So I'd just like to read a short extract from the introduction to set the scene. So I'm quite interested in etymology and derivation of words. And interestingly, the term excellence comes from the Latin, meaning excellere, meaning out or lofty. Whereas expertise comes from a Latin word that means to try, and is also the origin of experience and experiment. Now, as in many sectors, the rhetoric in higher education is one of excellence. And yet excellence in teaching is poorly understood, and by definition is a characteristic achievable only by a few. The notion of excellence, therefore, is not a strong motivator for individuals to improve their teaching, nor a helpful guide for them supporting them in doing so. However, now more than ever, it's important that teaching in higher education is of high quality in order to enable the increased number and diversity of students to learn effectively and to receive value for their tuition fee. This book offers a new discourse and a practical framework to inform individuals wanting to improve their teaching and to those supporting them. To this end, this book provides a contemporary view of the characteristics of expertise for teaching in higher education, based on the strong foundation of research into expertise and empirical and practical knowledge of the development of teaching in higher education. This is a fresh approach to considering teaching and its improvement in higher education that takes a holistic view of the teacher in the context of their role interacting with learners. It's needed in order to help motivate and inform teachers to continue to improve and to recognise their emerging and developing expertise. It can help educational developers to consider the broad range of support that teachers require beyond just understanding theory and practice of curriculum design. And it's timely in that it offers a new lens on teaching quality in order to ensure that students have their higher education facilitated by teachers who are committed to continuing to develop and improve all the characteristics necessary for expertise in their profession. Now, as in many fields and professions, excellence in higher education is commonly assessed through outputs. In case of measures such as student satisfaction or graduate outcomes, certainly we have that in the Teaching Excellence Framework in England. And this measure of outputs effectively ignores a critical feature that distinguishes those with expertise from those with experience, which is a commitment to professional learning. If higher education institutions are to achieve their missions of excellence in education, then they must also foster and enable a culture of professional learning for teaching that's integrated into everyday practice rather than being seen as an add-on. Without this active institutional level commitment, expertise in teaching will only ever be a subculture of the few. Now, an interesting aside, since the book was written, interestingly, the Office for Students in England, in their consultation on the new version of the TEF, Teaching Excellence Framework, has as one of its features of excellence, support for staff professional development. So that's encouraging, I think. As illustrated in the examples throughout the book, this model of expertise connects a wide variety of concepts about teaching in higher education and brings them together into a coherent whole, which might be used as a starting point for designing development programmes, for exploring one's own personal and professional learning development, for enhancing learning and teaching, or for research and development projects, and also for wider strategic and policy initiatives related to enhancement and recognition. As a starting point for conversation, this model has already been powerful and evocative, and of course it's likely that it will evolve over time as it's used, discussed and researched in different ways. For me, the particular model of expertise isn't as important as the discourse it provokes and the challenge to our ways of thinking and practicing as teachers in higher education. So that was my brief extract from the introduction to the book. So I'd just like to briefly outline that model of expertise because that also provides the overall structure for the book. So what are the generic characteristics of expertise? So as I mentioned, there's a really extensive and deep literature around expertise. And I've kind of drawn from that to categorize those characteristics into three main areas. The first of these is subject knowledge and skills. So expertise is high performance in one domain based on subject knowledge and skills developed through study and experience. But it's not just about knowledge and skills. There's particular ways of thinking and practicing, and how our experience and immersion in our particular field enables highly effective application of knowledge and skills through particular approaches to problem solving, pattern recognition, making connections with the bigger picture, and so on. And then the third category, characteristic of expertise, is around practice and learning. Now, for some fields, individuals may have a predetermined physical or cognitive advantage. So, for example, if we think about the 4'8" Simone Biles, the Olympic gymnast, compared with the 7'1" Shaquille O'Neal, Olympic basketball player, they have physical advantages for their particular sports. But a huge amount of research indicates that even for them, expertise mainly develops through practice. Cognitive psychology and neuroscience research also suggests that experience in itself isn't sufficient for learning and development. And there must be an active analysis of that experience, or we might call that reflection, in order to make sense of it and use it for improvement. I know this to my detriment myself in practicing the banjo. If I just repeat things mindlessly, there's a significant chance that it just reinforces bad habits. So practice can make permanent. But if you're mindful and deliberate and reflective through that practice, then improvement can happen. So for teaching in higher education, I suggest that these three characteristics might look as follows. So our subject knowledge and skills, I've characterised as pedagogical content knowledge, which is broadly the interaction of knowledge about one's subject area with knowledge of pedagogy. And both of these are required for expertise in teaching. That ongoing professional learning and practice, in its broader sense, we would include self-reflection, peer observations, feedback from others, conversations with colleagues and students, as well as formal training and development. And all of these are critical for maintaining an up-to-date pedagogical content knowledge, but also for remaining flexible and agile to respond to change. And then the third area, those ways of thinking and practicing. So I've characterised that as artistry. This is what mediates the application of the pedagogical content knowledge. So good teaching isn't just about reproducing others' approaches or applying a pedagogical checklist. There's things around your teaching persona, performance and improvisation, relational aspects between teacher and learner. And that also links to your motivation and your care in your role as a teacher. And our second expertise symposium, which we're starting to plan now to be held in October this year, is going to have artistry of teaching as its main theme. So do watch this space for further information. So the book explores all of these aspects of expertise in more depth through a range of contributions from colleagues in Australia, Canada, China, the Netherlands, UK and USA. And through sharing their research and practice in relation to these themes, they've provided practical ideas and examples and provocations for developing our expertise as teachers in higher education. So I'm going to very briefly give you a sense of the kind of the content of the book, but without kind of going through in fine detail. So our first kind of introductory part is really about broader perspectives on expertise for teaching in higher education, which I introduced by going into more depth about those three characteristics of expertise. Other contributions also include looking at it from a whole university approach, as opposed to from an individual teacher approach. And also, I think one of the important things about expertise is it does tend to be confined to one domain. We all have our particular area of expertise, so that it's really important that for something like teaching, that we are collaborative and we engage with the expertise of others. So that's explored in relation to the expertise of disabled people. We also need to be thinking about the perspectives of, particularly if we're thinking about self-reflection and student feedback and so on, the perspectives of our learners and how their kind of evaluation of what we do, how does that link into their knowledge of excellence and expertise? And there's an interesting chapter there exploring the fact that there may be gender differences in students' perceptions of excellence, and that actually expertise perhaps offers a better discourse for students to understand. And then the remaining three parts are structured around those three characteristics of expertise. We've got further exploration around pedagogical content knowledge, looking at professional identity, and then the complex identities we often have as teachers in higher education, where we're also researchers, perhaps also connected into professional practice. We then look at professional learning for teaching in higher education, with some examples of different approaches to professional learning and development. And then the final part starts to explore this notion of artistry of teaching. And for me, I think this is particularly interesting, is it's something that's starting to emerge over the last few years. I'm hearing more people starting to talk about performance and improvisation, relational pedagogy and so on. So I think this is a really interesting sort of introduction to some of those ideas. So now that I've introduced the book, I'd like to explore the concepts a little bit further. Through a conversation with a colleague who has multiple perspectives on expertise, from his own experience as a surgeon, a GP, and more recently, a UK National Teaching Fellow. And he's also had interviews with experts in a wide range of fields, including tailors, taxidermists, jazz pianists, and musicians. So Roger Kneebone trained first as a general and trauma surgeon, working both in the UK and in Southern Africa. After finishing his specialist training, he decided to become a general practitioner and joined a large group practice in Trowbridge, Wiltshire. In the 1990s, he pioneered an innovative national training programme for minor surgery within primary care, based around intensive workshops using simulated tissue models and a computer-based learning programme. In 2003, Roger left his practice to join Imperial College. And there he directs the Imperial College Centre for Engagement and Simulation Science, and also directs the Royal College of Music Imperial College Centre for Performance Science. And this ambitious collaboration, launched in 2016, explores challenges of performance across domains from arts, education and business to medicine, science and sport. Roger is committed to education in its widest sense. And in July 2011, he became the first Imperial academic to receive a UK National Teaching Fellowship Award. He established and co-leads the UK's only Masters in Surgical Education, and this innovative programme builds on educational theory and practice to frame surgical education as an intersection between the biomedical sciences, the humanities and social science, and the visual and performing arts. And part of the reason I'm giving this extensive introduction is I find this is a really interesting illustration of the intersection of all those different characteristics of expertise, even in lots of different fields, particularly we've got that notion of artistry coming forward. Somewhat unusually for a book launch, I'd also like to refer you to Roger's own book on expertise, Expert: Understanding the Path to Mastery, which provides a fabulous insight into the general characteristics of expertise through his reflections on his own medical career and interviews with others. And if you'd rather listen to stories of expertise, I'd also recommend Roger's podcast, Countercurrent. Roger kindly wrote the foreword to Developing Expertise for Teaching in Higher Education. I'm delighted to welcome here today to share his perspectives on teaching in higher education. So Roger, could you tell us a little bit about your teaching, how you learned to teach, and what do you do to continue to learn and develop?
Yes, well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this book launch, and it's fantastic to see your book coming out. And so many of the ideas that you've talked about resonate with ideas I've been thinking about myself over a number of years now, that I think are sort of beginning to come into focus now in new and interesting ways. I mean, to give you a little bit of a sense of my own experience, I mean, I think I've always been interested in teaching, but for a very long time, I kind of did it without benefit of clergy, so to speak. You know, I didn't really have much of a training in it or anything, and so I, as you mentioned, I got a medical background, and so I trained as a medical student in the 1970s, and then I wanted to become a surgeon. So at that time, and still to this day, if you want to become a surgeon, you have to take some pretty fearsome exams, and one of them deals a lot with anatomy, and I hadn't been very diligent as a student, I have to confess, and so I really had a long way to go in learning up all the stuff I needed to know in detail for the anatomy part of this exam. And so I spent a year teaching medical students about anatomy. I spent a year I'd been a doctor qualified for a year, and then I took a year out of clinical work and went back to the university where I'd trained, the University of Manchester, and spent a long time teaching anatomy to medical students. And I was kind of one step ahead of them, really, only, I think. And I was, to me, that was a formative experience because I was teaching in the dissecting room. There's a lot of dissection of cadavers, people who donated their bodies to science at that time. And so I got the experience of working with groups of 8 or 10 students at a time. But because it was quite a large class, I would do that four times each time, each topic, and started to experience what it was to be trying to explain to other people things and ideas that I was only beginning to become confronted with myself. And so that was a sort of formative experience for me. Then I carried on throughout my surgical training, both of course being taught, but also teaching at the same time, because the clinical world is very much like that. You're always in a group of people who are, some of whom are more experienced, others are less experienced than you. And so there is a sort of continual to and fro of perspectives about all the things you're doing. As I became more experienced as a surgeon and then became a consultant, I had more specific responsibilities for teaching less experienced people. But I think all this really came into a sharp focus when I then changed direction completely, as you mentioned, and became a GP. So changed from having been a hospital doctor to being a family doctor in a practice in Wiltshire, which was very different from doing trauma surgery in Southern Africa, which is where I'd been for the previous few years. And I had a disquieting experience myself in spending a year as a GP trainee. So learning the very different, apparently similar, but in fact very different way of practicing that general practice requires. And we can maybe talk a bit about that at the moment, because in a moment, because I think that ties very much into your idea of artistry. But then as I became more experienced as a GP, I took our practice through the process of becoming approved as a training practice. And I myself went through a number of training programs to become recognized as a trainer, as somebody who could then take responsibility for younger, well, less experienced doctors coming into the world of general practice. And I did that for quite a long time. And then in the next stage of my career, joined a university, as you said, and at Imperial College, have different responsibilities now, having set up and continuing to lead this master's in education, in surgical education. And through all these stages, I think I've started to learn more and more about what it is to teach, but particularly what it is to develop responsibilities, not only for the pedagogical content knowledge side of things, as you were putting it out there, but to develop relationships of care for other people that go beyond the transmission of isolated facts or specific skills, but to think more widely about what it is to be part of a community where people are always learning and teaching. Does that make sense, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm sort of hearing through your story there is actually you've learnt to teach through obviously some formal training, but also through your experience as a learner at different stages in your career. And so that relationship between student and teacher, the relational aspects of it, is actually something you've almost experienced yourself in that.
Yeah, I think I've experienced it through immersion, as many mm-hmm. people have. But I think I've only, I mean, at the time I was doing those clinical things, which I'm not doing now, but at the time, I think I was concentrating very much on what I was learning and then what I was teaching, rather than how I was learning it and how I was teaching it. And I think it's only now, looking back on all those various experiences, that things are becoming clear that at the time I hardly noticed. Because at the time, for example, when I was taking those exams, I wasn't thinking about how I was teaching students. I was thinking about how I could gather the knowledge that I needed to pass those exams. And that happened at various stages. And it was only, I think, when I started to become a bit more experienced in sort of life in general, that I began to think about the relationship between the way I was teaching and indeed learning and the content. And I had a very interesting experience when, I mean, you talked about playing the banjo. And I my equivalent is learning to play the harpsichord, which is a peculiar instrument, but I've been doing that for quite a long time, and it happened, and I for a long time saw that as a an antidote to work, if you see what I mean, you know, something to do in time off and a way of recharging and a different kind of interest. When I was a GP, I then started to do, I did a higher degree in education, essentially, and at the same time was having harpsichord lessons. And what I was looking at in this, when I was working towards my PhD, was how people teach and learn surgical skills that for experts, senior surgeons, for example, are so much part of everyday life for them that they no longer recognize them as a thing to be learnt. Whereas for people who are just beginning or have never really done much in the way of surgery, they don't even know what they don't know about these things. And this comes to a focus when I was developing training courses for GPs in starting to do minor procedures, you know, to cut out lumps and bumps and do procedures that they hadn't done. And it seemed to me that there was a very interesting area of unarticulated knowledge about the kind of things that you needed to know about and be able to do in order to function as in an area you were beginning to expand, in the case of the GPs doing these practical procedures that involve cutting things out and so on. And while I was doing that, I was running courses for GPs, and I was first of all teaching them how to do these things, and the focus was on the things. But then when I was having harpsichord lessons with my teacher, who's a very gifted teacher, I recognized that she was making choices. She was identifying things that she, with her vast experience as a performer and a recording artist and a broadcaster and a recitalist, all those things, was able to identify, was identifying in what she saw in what I was doing, that enabled her to focus our joint attention on what was most productive at that moment. And it might be specific things about how to play this note or this bar or whatever, or it might be thinking about whether this was the right piece of music to be looking at in the first place anyway, or she might be thinking, was this a good time for me to move up a level and maybe play in front of some other people or whatever. She was clearly taking a whole lot of things into consideration at the same time around me as a learner and her as a teacher, which went far beyond the repertoire and the individual aspects of technique. And I suddenly a penny dropped with me that there were parallels between what she was doing with me as a learner and what I was doing with the GPs as a teacher. And to me, that was a bit of an epiphany, because I had kept the two in separate boxes before that. And I wondered if that made sense to you in terms of these multiple identities we have.
Very much so. And I mean, I've experienced something with my similar thing with my banjo teacher as well, in the way that he teaches. What I think was really interesting was what you said about unarticulated knowledge. And I think one of the real challenges for teaching, and I don't think it's exclusively higher education, but I think there's a particular interesting element to it, is that we are experts in our domain as well, subject domain as well, either through research or professional practice and so on. And so it's so much part of who we are and what we do, that in order to unpack that to help others learn is actually quite difficult, and it is quite a skill in itself. And maybe that's kind of part of that artistry of teaching, is to be able to put yourself in the shoes of your learners.
There's something about recognizing what is most important to deal with it, you know, because it's quite possible to swamp people with a whole load of stuff, isn't it? And so developing the judgment of what to focus on at a particular moment with a particular person, I think, is something that I think you need to have made a lot of mistakes along the way and thought about it and had a lot of different experiences that helps you. I mean, rather in the way that clinical judgment develops, I think pedagogical judgment develops, but it takes time.
Absolutely, and I've seen that in the development of newer lecturers, where you start off and you kind of very good, well-intentioned, is trying to just cram in as much content as he possibly can, sort of transfer that to the student. But over time, you certainly see people kind of stepping away from that, and it's more about moves more to that kind of problem solving and helping students to develop their own ways of thinking and practicing, rather than it all being about just stuffing in knowledge. And I think that's your development of expertise as a teacher, very much connects into how you then support your learners.
Yeah. But I think that requires fine judgment, doesn't it? Because I think it requires a sort of putting yourself in somebody else's position, trying to work out where they are and where they're coming from and where they want to go. And very often, shutting up and listening. And I think at the beginning, certainly I found, going back to that early experience of teaching anatomy, you know, I felt an urge to be seen to be teaching and to be conveying stuff. But actually, I think very often the most useful thing you can do is provide quiet space for people to put their ideas into a way that they can express them, and then maybe engaging with them around those ideas and you know picking up a whole lot of stuff that needs quietness, I think, and calm for these things to emerge.
Definitely, and that's something I picked up in your book as well. I think you were talking about, in the context of being a GP, and how your sort of mindset shifted from kind of imparting your knowledge and being the knowledgeable practitioner to actually actively listening and involving your patients. And I see a similar thing in teaching, where people seem to move from that sort of teacher-centered approach to a more student-centered approach.
Yes, and I think it is a shift of, I mean, I think there's something about the effect of anxiety on making you want to put out there stuff that you know and establish your credentials, things like that. And one of the interesting things about general practice for me was that, whereas in hospital medicine, as you become more and more experienced, you become more and more knowledgeable, and you become more and more comfortable about knowing what needs to be known in a circumscribed area, and being able to do, and in the case of surgery particularly, being able to do some of that stuff as well. And it becomes feasible to have a reasonable working knowledge of what the field itself consists of, and a deep knowledge of the bits of it that you've decided to focus on particularly within it. When you go into general practice, all that is just demolished, because you cannot possibly know. You need to have a sort of overall sense of the landscape, I think, but you can't possibly know very much about any of it, really. And so your skills are not those that the world of hospital practice, and indeed the lead up to that as a medical student, because that's dominated, I think, still by hospital practice, leads you to believe that medicine is all about, because it leads you to believe that medicine is all about populating your internal filing cabinets with a whole lot of knowledge and specific skills, and then applying those to whoever's in front of you so that you can make a diagnosis and then know what to do and then do it. In general practice, though, it's totally different, because people come to you as the first port of call. They haven't been filtered by anybody else, and so they may come with things that are recognisably medical, or they may come with things that are completely different. And you just cannot shoehorn people into these categories. And you recognise after a while, at least I came to recognise, that what you need to do is shut up and sit and listen and try and work out what really is the issue that person that is exercising with, you know, what they've come with, because then you can decide. Once you've decided between you what it is, or at least started to frame it, you can then think about how best to address it. And it may be that that it needs a specific medical treatment, and you know what that is, and you can do it, so you do it. Or it may be that it needs a different kind of medical treatment that you don't know how to do it, but you know someone who can, and so you contact them. Or it may be that it's not medical at all, and it's much more to do with housing or social care or education or all kinds of things. And then you may have to call on completely different people, and so you have to stand back and stop thinking that you're the only person who can provide answers, but to think, what can you do to help frame the question, I think. And that again means letting go of that feeling that you are under an obligation to show that you know stuff and can do stuff. And that, although you do need to know stuff and you need to know how to do stuff, you kind of put that in a corner and leave it there until it's needed.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that resonates really strongly with teaching in higher education. It's a similar thing. Our students are coming from a wide variety of backgrounds, and many things that are influencing how they are in at that moment in time. And it's not just about you in the classroom. There might be other things going on as well. And I think that idea of kind of the need to establish credibility, I think, you know, it's one of the things.
Yeah. Being comfortable with not knowing.
Yeah. And I think that's...
that doesn't mean you are an ignorant person or that you are of no use. It means that you don't feel the need to feel unsettled by areas of not knowing. And that's okay, I think. But that does take a bit of experience, because I think the system that we've been through kind of generates anxiety to begin with. An anxious need to prove ourselves. And I think, I don't know whether that's a function of the educational system or simply something that comes with having, you know, with gaining experience.
And I think that's a really valuable thing to share with our students as well, because they're developing their expertise in the subject area. And depending on their kind of schooling background, many years ago when I went to university, I kind of had the idea that there'll be answers to everything, because that's what I was given at school. It's like, here's all the facts. And it was quite a change for me to realise actually there aren't answers to everything, particularly in science or in any subject area. So what you need is the tools to ask the questions and find out things, and developing that awareness that even the experts in the field don't have the answers to anything was a really, you know, a really valuable lesson, actually, and was sort of helped the development of my expertise. So I think there's lots of things that we can share with our students to help them learn as well. Yeah, so I just wanted to pick up on, you've sort of popped in a range of lovely kind of words and phrases. And there were things there around kind of the relational aspects of teaching, listening, care. And I think there's something there about patience as well, which you could take in both words, no pun intended for healthcare. But actually, you know, we might jump to solutions and answers much more quickly because we have that expertise, because we've got that knowledge in our minds. We've categorized it in our minds in particular ways that it's known experts are able to do. And we need to be patient with our students because they're novices. They may have some of the knowledge, they won't have it all, but they won't necessarily know how it all links together. And it could be really easy. And I know the classic example is asking a question and then jumping straight in with the answer because someone else doesn't answer within 2 seconds. But we need to remember that kind of the novice expert continuum and have that patience and the listening. And as you said, giving that space for learning.
I think that giving the space for learning is really important, because I think partly it sets the tone for a conversation or an interchange where that provides people the freedom to think and come up with ways of articulating what they're thinking without being left behind by a conversation that goes so fast that it sort of swamps that. And I think that's a skill that needs to be studied by some people. I mean, some people do it naturally, but I think that sort of relaxing and giving time for things to sort of emerge can be very important. And becoming comfortable with silence, I think, is quite difficult, you know, because 10 seconds seems like 10 minutes when you're waiting in a conversation, doesn't it? And you can think that people aren't saying something because either they don't understand what you've said or they find it boring or whatever. But actually, it may be simply that they're organising their thoughts and wondering how to respond. And I used to find that a lot with patients, is that, you know, you really needed to become comfortable with silence. But that was often at odds with the need to do something in 10 minutes. And the real experts that I worked with were able to square that circle. I think they were able to give people time to feel unhurried, but nonetheless to manage the bigger picture of, 20 people to see that morning, and then visits, and then whatever it was, to sort of move between an intense focus on the person they were with and an awareness of the system within which they were working. And I think, again, that sort of when I was a GP trainee myself for a year, I was focusing on what happened in my consulting room and trying to develop some of these skills. And it wasn't until later that when I was a partner in a practice that I became aware of all these wider institutional things, such as, making sure that the surgeries ran on time and who would be on call if there were problems, all that kind of stuff. And I think that has parallels with, if you're teaching in an organization, whether it's a university or whatever, there are conflicting obligations and pressures, aren't they? And they're not always easy to reconcile. And you would like to sometimes spend more time with your students than you can because of all the other things you've got to do. Everybody experiences that all the time. But I think that one of the things about becoming expert, perhaps, is becoming more adept at managing those emotions.
So yes, it's actually that kind of problem solving part of expertise is linked into that, how you manage your time and juggling all those different things and identities.
I think so. And I mean, in the book that I wrote, obviously this is about the book that you wrote, but one of the things that struck me when I was thinking about what happens when people move from not knowing anything about something to many decades later knowing such a lot and having such wisdom that they can pass that on to other people, is that there is this very interesting intermediate stage where you have to deal with a tension between thinking that what you're doing is a means for you to demonstrate all the stuff you've learnt and learnt how to do. The exams you've passed and stuff, realizing that nobody else cares about that, and that actually that is only a means towards being able to do something with somebody else, for somebody else. What the magicians in that I met say, it's not about you, it's about them. It's not about what you can do with your hands, it's about whether you can make other people feel that what you're doing, believe that what you're doing is something impossible. And at the same time, developing your own individuality and your uniqueness as a teacher or a clinician or an academic or whatever it is. And those things can be an uncomfortable tension sometimes, because it isn't about you, but at the same time it is about you, and that requires, I think, quite a lot of juggling to keep those two balls in play, and you use that as a way of developing along your own path towards becoming more expert, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm conscious of time, so I've just got sort of one last question, and then I'm going to hand it to Sean to see if there's been anything in the chat box we can have a look at. You've probably sort of picked up on quite a lot of this already, but in order to write the foreword for the book, Developing Expertise for Teaching in Higher Education, you did review the introductory chapters and get a sense of kind of the broad model of it. So what have you taken away from this model of expertise, and how might you apply it to your own teaching? There's anything else?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the book, but it was fascinating because so much of what you said resonated with ideas I've been thinking about a lot. And I think, to me, this idea of artistry is very powerful. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about that, but you've sort of put it into a very interesting way of thinking, I think, because that is an aspect, I think, of professional practice in many areas which is often overlooked. And I think it's often assumed that because people know a lot and can do a lot, that they will be able to that they'll be able to have effective teaching relationships, for example. And that idea of thinking about, certainly in the world of science, and I wouldn't describe myself as a scientist, but I'm working in a very scientific institution. And of course, there is scientific knowledge, of course, a lot of it in the world of medicine too. But that idea that there are things like elegance and gracefulness and responsiveness to an aesthetic and things like that. I think those things are very much there in the worlds of laboratory science and engineering and creative design and things, but they're not recognized by name. And so I think that there's something really important from what you were saying about bringing out into view those aspects of professional work, whatever it might happen to be, that you might think of in terms of artistry.
Yeah, thank you. And as I said, it's something, I mean, so I'm an education developer. I've worked supporting staff for many years. And it's really only relatively recently that we've sort of gone beyond just helping them with the pedagogical content knowledge or mostly the pedagogy, and starting to think about what are those relational aspects in the classroom? You know, what's the performance aspect? And I know a lot of people are uncomfortable with the concept of performance and teaching. But there is something there about your teaching persona. Definitely, there's a lot about improvisation.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm not at all uncomfortable about that word, but I think that a lot of people are. And I think maybe performing sometimes works better than performance because, you know, in the way that I sometimes draw a distinction between expertise and becoming expert, you know, because expertise can be seen as a sort of disembodied thing that's almost separate from people. And I think that performance can be seen as a sort of disembodied thing that's almost separate from people. But actually, when we talk about performing, and once we get over this business of performing sort of equals being inauthentic, once we can nail that one, because I think it's absolutely the reverse. I think performing is how we do what we do, whatever it is that we do. If that doesn't sound too complex. Then these issues around the way we do things bring, I think, really important qualities into view, such as elegance and timing and the feeling of it being right. You know, all these things that are very hard to define, but they're very much part, I think, of expert practice in many, many areas. And teaching is a particularly good example, I think.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. I'm conscious of time. So, Sean, I see the chat box is quite active with comments and so on. But are there any questions that you'd like to pick out?
Oh, there are loads, if I'm honest, Helen, but I'm gonna try and pick two or three, maybe. There's a really good one that came in quite early on from Yusuf that I think might be quite interesting to start us off with. I'm going to adapt it slightly, but the question is, who would this book benefit, or who would benefit from this book, I should say, and how would it benefit them?
That's a great question. So I would say anyone who's got an interest in teaching in higher education, so that would be people themselves who teach and are interested in exploring, you know, something that's a bit wider than just the knowledge and skills, thinking about that broader perspective. But also people like myself who are education developers and support those who teach, just to sort of give that kind of broader perspective around learning and teaching. I think it's also just, I mean, I would say this is my area of research. I just find it just really interesting exploring the concepts of expertise. And for me, it's all about curiosity. And there's a really strong link, I think, between teaching and research, which is around curiosity and what's going on in the classroom and how can I make things better. And I think I certainly found that came out through the book, as well as ideas around learning about teaching being a community thing. It's not something you do on your own. We learn from other people. And this concept of care that's come up quite a lot in our conversation today. So I think some of those ideas there are just really interesting if you're just curious about teaching and about, you know, student learning.
Thank you, Helen. I have a second question from Mary. Mary's asking about how the kind of things you're discussing in your book and that people are discussing to do with expert and expertise, how you think they relate to Bransford's idea of the virtuoso. So I've got a quick quote that Mary put in that I think I'm going to put in the chat window. It's a slightly long one, but I think the key bit here is the bottom line there, which is about virtuosos in contrast to artisans. not only apply expertise to a given problem, but they also consider whether the problem as presented is the best way to begin.
Interesting. So I noticed at the beginning of that quote, there's a thing around adaptive expertise. And that's not something I addressed directly, but in the book, but actually this concept of adaptive expertise is really what I'm thinking about as expertise. There's lots of other ways of thinking of expertise, some of them just focused around the knowledge and skills. But that notion of adaptation and flexibility, I think, is really important. So expertise is not just applying something to a problem, but actually looking at the problem in the first place. There's definitely a lot around problem solving in that concept of ways of thinking and practicing. And what one analogy I like to give is something I remember from when I did physics at university. And we used to have this exam called general physics, which could be on absolutely anything that we covered. And I would dread it, because my way of learning was pretty much rote learning. So if you give me a problem and I know, and I've seen it before, I'll think, right, which equation do I stick in here? Right, pop that in, here's an answer. But we were given problems in different ways. So rather than specifically, you know, Newton's laws of motion or something like that, it'll be something much more in context. So two planes take off from the same spot, fly opposite ways around the world, which one arrives back first, and questions like that. And as a learner, that presented me with huge problems, because you couldn't just plug in a number to an equation. You had to figure out actually what's going on first. So you had to reframe the problem for yourself and think, well, what's actually happening here? And then what sort of order of magnitude answer am I looking for? And at that point, you then start thinking about, well, what might the equations be? And that's something that's seen in sort of expertise research is that approach to problem solving is very much about kind of reframing the problem, contextualizing it. Roger, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add to that.
No, that's a very interesting point. I think this whole idea of adaptive expertise is a really interesting one. And I think what you were saying about reframing the problem and seeing that as a collaborative activity between you particularly and a learner who might be struggling, I used to find, going back to my clinical experience, for example, that a patient might come to my surgery and say, look, I've just come because I need some antibiotics. And to begin with, I would think, okay, well, you know, what's the problem? You need the antibiotic. And here are the antibiotics or not. But then I started to think, well, you know, why is it that this person wants antibiotics? What is the problem that they think antibiotics will solve? And very often it would turn out that it wasn't a problem that was best solved by antibiotics. It was a different problem, or could be framed in a different way. And I think there's something similar there with a lot of the issues that people might struggle with in the educational world. And that sometimes it's really important to take a step back and as you say, just check out whether the problem that you're both putting a lot of effort into solving is indeed the problem, or whether it's just either part of it or a different issue or whatever. And I think that goes back to the adaptive expertise versus routine expertise that Berreiter and Scott Amelia talk about a lot, which I think is a really interesting way of thinking about things. And it made me think that, going back to this idea of attentional capacity, my understanding of that, of the adaptive expertise, is that as people become more experienced in that way of thinking, they reallocate their freed up attentional capacity that is freed up by them getting better at what they're doing into progressive problem solving, not just into doing the same thing again and again or doing other things with another part of your brain, but actually pushing themselves out and testing themselves at the edges of what they are comfortable in doing. And I think that is a characteristic, isn't it, of people who continue to remain interested in what they're doing and continue to bring other people with them. And I think a lot of that is stuff that your book is going to make people think about.
I think I had a really interesting example from that. So some of what initiated my research in this was around, I had interviews with 9 National Teaching Fellows. And I remember one of them in physics was talking about how they develop their teaching over time, starting off with kind of taking in notes and almost reading from a script. and then starting to be curious about what was going on in the classroom and why not all of the students got it. And so they would try out something new or try a different technique, and they were doing really, really well by most of our measures, but they were still curious. They still wanted to kind of do that progressive problem solving and see, you know, what else could they do, how they could make things better. And I thought that was sort of quite a nice example of that approach. And the idea that, you know, I think the thing I like with expertise rather than excellence is expertise is a journey. It's not an end point. You know, when you speak to most professional elite level musicians or athletes or so on, you know, they're not at the end of their journey. They still see there's places to go, ways to get better, things to progress on. And I think that, you know, that was really valuable with these National Teaching Fellows. They've been teaching 15, 20 years, but they still felt there was different ways of doing things. They wanted to solve these problems to support their students even better. So I think that was a key characteristic. I am very conscious of time. It's 1:30, so I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up there. I will have a look at the chat box and see if there's any questions that haven't been answered. But please do feel free to drop me an email. So the book is going to be actually published on the 22nd of March, all being well, I hope, available for pre-order. If you'd like to ask any more questions, please do feel free to email me. I'm always happy to chat about it. Keep an eye out for the next symposium. The main theme will be artistry in its broadest sense, but we can also look at other aspects of expertise. So I'd just like to say thank you so much for everyone for coming along, for your interesting comments and questions. Huge thank you to Roger for fantastic insights and just so interesting hearing those analogies with other professions. I think it's really, you know, lots of valuable things we can learn from that. So thank you very much, everybody, and very much hope you enjoy the book. And of course, thank you to all the contributors, without whom it would never have been possible.